Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is a podcast about the American Revolution. I'm reading from a book by Dale Anderson, Events and Outcomes of the American Revolution. It's, I suppose, a kid's book on it, but it's very good. Now, those sort of second thread to this is rehabilitation, trying to remember things and read and do things. And so people may have heard me over a bit over a year of just slow rehabilitation, and I'm slowly upping the ante in the amount that I read, or the complexity of what I read, or reflect, or remember and discuss. And this is going to be a little bit different in that I'm going to not actually read word for word, but read a section and then paraphrase it. So you'll hear me stop and start from time to time. But I can go on the first section. The first section is the introduction, why there is a... why was there a revolution? And thing says that the revolution started, or the book says it started in 1776. I know that's because I think I was in there in 75, so there's a big set of celebrations in the United States, 200 years since the revolution, which is pretty remarkable. If you look at, you know, what the United States has achieved and what Australia has achieved in 200 years, it's pretty chalk and cheese, that type of stuff. But you have the American Revolution, and the general question was, it started off very much with the Declaration of Independence very early in the Revolution, before any real battles started. You had the Declaration of Independence, and that sort of guided what everyone fought for. But, sort of reading further into the book, and this is not going here, the American Revolution was... independence of 13 separate states. It was only later, by conventions and stuff like that, that they got the system of government in. So they got the revolution first, and they had a convention of states, of independent states, and only when the independent states couldn't work together as a country did they form the American country as we now recognise it, with a flag and a system of government and a first president. The first president didn't come until several years after the revolution. They had to actually get good George Washington back out of retirement, and he was sort of a goodwill founder of America. But they had they have a quote from Benjamin Franklin about how people actually rather liked being British subjects underneath the colony. And here's a quote. They had not only a respect, but an affection for Great Britain, for its laws, customs and manners, and even a fondness of its fashions. And then the question says, well, if we had a declaration early on, what was the sequence that went out? And they say, to start off, there's 13 colonies, but the 13 colonies can be thought... I'm just paraphrasing this in three sections. There was actually, and I didn't know this, that there was poor farmland north of New York. So that Maine, Connecticut, Massachusetts was poor farmland. Then that's in the north. And then you've got the northern states of, or central states of New York, Pennsylvania, which had good farmland. So up the north was people, fishers and traders, then there was farmers in the middle, and at the bottom was the slave owners and the plantation owners. I think, just reading it, was 40% of the population was slaves, and so you had this thing that America had to get going, but also had to, it didn't want slaves, and down the bottom it did have slaves, a much less populous, and these people with a large slave population had to have some way of counting their slaves. So it's really interesting. I'm going to stop there as I read a little bit furthermore. There's a section there about exactly who were the colonists. It was actually a bit less than I expected reading over it, and they said the majority of them were British. There were some enclaves of Germans, and then at the bottom, in the south, there was a large number of black African slaves who, the vast majority, who had no rights. I also know that there were some colonies of Swedish people. There was an area called New Sweden up near Delaware, which I saw there. They said how the governments, how the colonies were originally governed, and I do know this from establishing charters. Now, you can charter a university, and you can actually charter a colony, and I do know that Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon was involved in the chartering of several colonies. There was also religious colonies, so it was. I think you had the English Civil War and that type of stuff in the 1600s. So they got the people out there in the colonies, and they really didn't pay much attention to them until the end of the 17th century, which is around 1690, after the civil wars had gone down. They had the Georges there, and they rather than a chartered thing, they became a royal colony, which I don't quite understand the difference in. So a royal colony had basically a representative of the king, so it became more, rather than an outpost, like a trading outpost, it became a royal thing. The king was placed on top of a system which was already there of voters and autonomous rule. Throughout the 1600s, it says here, there was rebellions in Virginia, Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania. The protests and rebellions were about the centralist power of the governor. Now, it is interesting that we had the Rum Rebellion in Australia. Oh, I suppose it's after the American War of Independence. It gives you, the Rum Rebellion was an out-and-out, basically, real estate agents wanting to grab Australia from the Crown, and it didn't take much to, it was just didn't have the substance of it. So I'm going to read the next section about trade and read that to you. So this next section is on the importance of trade. So building up, we've got, American Revolution, what happened. You had the idea that certain colonies, there's colonists of a certain group, and they had a way of governing the colonies, but the sort of main mechanical function, as I described here, was trade. Now, the idea of the model of trade at the moment was that a country needed resources and a market, and if you could control a colony and make it the exclusive source of your resources and a customer, you could actually build your economy by excluding other people. They organized that. So Britain passed more and more laws to restrict trade, to make it between Britain and the United States. So it's sort of like the reverse of a free trade existence. But the actual, although they were on the books, they were what's called statutory. They're called statutory neglect. Everybody didn't actually pay much attention to it. Then you have the Seven Years' War, which was a pretty spectacular swap power swap in the French power vacuum, the Zaffanese War, which it's really interesting how this sequence of events goes, in that the Seven Years' War, France lost a lot of power and territory to the Americans, to the British, and so the French became a sort of antagonistic to Britain after the Seven Years' War. So the Seven Years' War was a spectacular loss of French territory to Britain. So they took, basically, in the Seven Years' War, they took England. India, and they lost the French lost their claims, a lot of claims and controls in North America. So the sort of the power structure, or the power concerns in America of France. American colonies being British against the French. The French were removed at the end of the Seven Years' War. It's quite sort of amazing to think about how powerful the French were. So I'm just going to read this next section. This is the introduction. Now is chapter one, the origins of the revolution. And there's a map of America here, a huge British territory taken from France. So this is basically the French owned from the Appalachian Mountains to the Mississippi. I really don't quite understand the Louisiana Purchase in it, because it looks as though France has got nothing. So I don't quite understand. There must be a sequence then. So you've got Britain, you have British territory taken from Spain, which is Florida. I thought Florida was Spanish, but so Britain somehow beat Spain as well, took Florida, and then took a huge amount of territory from France and North America, just unbelievable amount, all the way up through to Quebec, Montreal, all that type of stuff. And I think Ontario, Toronto wasn't there quite yet. And I'm just really trying to look at it all. And then there's the rest of America is nominally a Spanish territory. So it's a pretty amazing sequence there. So they're the result of the Seven Years' War. There's a sudden flop of territory falls to Britain. And then, when the Americans revolt, they take a lot of what's we think of as in a sequence there. The Seven Years' War gave a lot of territory to Britain from other countries, and then when America beat Britain, they took the land that Britain had taken off the other countries. It's interesting to look at. Okay, I'm just reading one page, and it's really enough for my poor little brain to take in. The North American continent was divided up between Spain at the west coast, in the middle, and from Canada down, the French, and just a strip hugging the Atlantic was the British, and then the Seven Years' War, which happened in the 1650s, ended in a treaty in 1763, gave a large section of the French section back to the British, and some of the Spanish section gave to the British for the first time. They then had the problem of blending, as they say, blending the French colonies and the British colonies together. There was a uprising, which I do know about, around Lake Ontario by the Pontiac. I remember that Pontiac potatoes, Pontiac. Indian tribes who didn't want, who had an Indian rebellion, and The British had to send out troops and put down the rebellion. And then the result of this is that the English realised that if they pissed off the French Indians, or the Indians who were allied to France, they'd have to have put up large armies. So they restricted the colony's expansion into the new territory. So it was like the British actually said that the Americans can't expand. So there was a sort of an overall tension that the states saw this power vacuum, wanted to move in, but they realised that the British would have to provide soldiers to fight the Indians. So they said, look, you can't cross the Appalachian Mountains. So the Appalachian Mountains are the mountain chain, going back here, and this is interesting to me, you know the Rockies. Appalachian Mountains look pretty much similar to the Blue Mountains in terms of it's a long chain. So we've got in Australia the Great Dividing Range, in the US they've got the Appalachian Mountains, and the Kentucky and all that type of stuff. One of the things is that the British realised that they needed a large army, and at the start they only had 3,755 troops. So really, to try and put that into perspective, that's three large high schools at, here. That's not a lot of troops. Not all those would have been fighting troops, there'd be officers. So the amount of fighting men would be probably perhaps around 2,000 at most. This is my own view. And so so in 1763, John Grenville needed to expand the number of troops to get the number of troops they needed to raise more taxes. So the way to easily raise taxes is place duties on goods. What has happened is that they previously tried to raise taxes by goods, but it was ignored. People just didn't pay taxes. So it sort of really strikes me that nothing much has changed. So you can see this lockstep. We've taken all this territory. We've got to rein in the Americans to stop them expanding over the Indians, because they can't afford to. We need more troops there. We've got to raise money for it. So there was colonial protests, and this is interesting in its rum as well. There's a sugar tax. So they had different taxes, and by taxing individual groups, the individual groups could morph around, so they had to keep on trying to come up with taxes which were more general and harder to avoid. But they taxed the rum. Now, I think Bourbon is a type of rum. I don't know the difference between whiskey and rum, unfortunately. So you've got the stills out the back of people having rum. It sort of really reminds me of the Rum Rebellion. Australia had a big interest in rum. So there's a quote here. It is just and necessary that a revenue be raised in your Majesty's said dominions in America. I don't know what that person said. Interesting aspect of it is that America and was formed, I think, a key ideal, sort of logic government, it's hard to say, there was the concept that you should apply logic to government, or a logic to society, was an Enlightenment principle. And Francis Bacon, someone who is just so easy to read, to understand from a scientific point, because he had the idea of induction. Yeah, the basic fundamental idea of induction and the investment of induction, this ability to create knowledge out of thin air, induction. And set up a scientific society, which set up the Royal Society, but also the American sort of an Enlightenment view. And into this was John Locke, Lockie, L-O-K-E, John Locke. And I have read about him, and the thing that I do remember about him, John Locke is an American, Enlightenment, 1690, around that time, wrote various things. He was, you know, vitally flawed, but what struck me is that he, at the end of all his logic thing, he said, "But I hate Catholics." Yeah, for all this general thing. So when you actually read it, there's that problem there. But he said that governments, people consent to be governed because there's a sort of basic social contract. I have the police will come in and look after me. There's a law of the land, and we consent to it. But this consent process means that you can have a corrupt government and you can get rid of it. And so and that a government, in order to give you services, must raise, must tax you. So this is interesting. So the problem is that they needed to raise money for the soldiers, but the problem was there was no representation, not that there was any I suppose, not that there was any true representation as we understand it at the moment. There was no universal suffrage. It was, you know, just the rich, basic, what we would say, the local mayor and real estate agents, the property developers, insist that they don't get pushed around. But there's a quote here that the Boston meeting said, "No parts of His Majesty's dominion can be taxed without consent." And what that really consent means, what? You imagine that you were a king and now the people saying, "Well, no, look, you can't take money off us without us agreeing to give you." And this is sort of be bizarre. And you've got to remember that the monarchs in Britain were not British, they were German. They were the Glorious Revolution. The British decided they couldn't stomach the British history associated with the Stuarts, I think they were, so they got rid of them. So after the Tudors, the Stuarts, probably something else. I really don't understand this too much, but then they got rid of them with the Three Georges. So the British, the sugar duty was a matter of justice, i.e. that, you know, you need troops, so you need to pay for your troops. It's sort of like Donald Trump saying, I want, you know, Germany to pull its weight. We can't have American troops. It's just such an bizarre, amazing story. Yes, so the thing is, the Americans didn't want to pay the tax, but it's an important point here is that they begin talking about their rights, the rights of man, and really they were just objecting to paying tax, sort of tax avoidance. So you can imagine someone in you know, not paying tax and saying, "I have a right not to be taxed." Then they introduced the stamp tax, which I do remember, and the stamp tax said that every legal document to be legal required a stamp, and you had to pay some money. So this meant that, you know, I could sell sugar on the sly and people would say, "Oh, this apple pie is very sweet. I wonder what's going on." And you'd be hard to tax. But at the end, if you want a diploma from a school or a property transacted, people would go back, "Well, this property is not legal." You could actually reinforce them. So the colonies really hated the stamp tax. You can imagine people thinking. It says here, Grenville planned this deliberately and wanted to create a widespread tax that could not be avoided. The effect, though, was to increase opposition to the tax. So this is sort of the recipe for disaster. And they said, now, this is interesting, the different legal systems. They objected because the prosecutions for failure to pay tax was handled by naval courts, So you can imagine that you've got your local courts in which actually import not only the tax, but you sort of a court system on top of it. So now this is interesting. The 1965, the House of Burgess, which is the Assembly Burgesses, which is something that Thomas Jefferson is. I'm sort of beginning to. So how I actually got into all of this is listening to the Hamilton play and just getting everyone shot to it, and it just seems so bizarre. And it was, to Australian ears, just this insane thing about sort of insider American knowledge that they were all excited about, but sounded bizarre to Australian ears. I think particularly the little ditty, no one knew, no one was in the room when it happened, and that was just, you know, it just really offended me, just listening to Hamilton. So I began to research it. Now, of course, you Americans know all about it. So there was the Virginia assemblies, and then there's mobs in the street attacking tax collectors at their homes. So they had a tax collector for all the 13 colonies, and in 1766, that's 10 years before, all tax collectors resigned. So that was one. And then the third action, they began to, besides meeting in Virginia, the mobs, they began to get organised and put a petition to the king. So they organised and wrote out a petition to the king. So that's it. The fourth was an economic attack. Merchants joined non-importation agreements. So it was sort of Donald Trump all over again. So that's the sequence of chain of events. The 7 years war, the requirement to pull in more troops to actually defend this huge territory, the requirement to raise taxes, the Americans not wanting to raise taxes, and then a whole series of problems unfolding because the idea that you suddenly have to consent to pay taxes, and the idea that if you want to prosecute taxes, you have to actually introduce your own legal system on top of it, and this whole series of things, this four sections. I'll just go through the four things again. So it was the House of Burgess. There was mobs attacking people. There was a petition, and then there was economic sabotage, so to speak. We're still in chapter one, reading the next section. The Parliament giveth and take away. Now, of all those four things, the actual economic one forced the British businessmen to urge Parliament, and Parliament then dropped the different taxes, and then it's Pitt. We've got Pitt Street here, They dropped the initial revolt worked, but the British said there are two things that we're now going to pass an Act of Parliament, that our strength of Parliament is actually enact. We can enact laws overseas. So they sort of, it sort of notched another step up. So that's that. If they put an Act of Parliament, it's no longer something you can debate. It's necessary. But, which I suppose is interesting, is that they thought it was really... The Americans loved her, and the Americans thought, George, you are such a lovely, lovely person, and we're going to build a huge statue of King George III. and that's an interesting big lead statue, and there's a bit of a story about that big statue. So the Americans actually built a statue to the king, so they think he's He's great. The problem is that it didn't solve the financial problem, so it's reading the next thing. So there's this Charles Tarwin, Townshend, now took over from Pitt, and decided to put import duties on paper, glass, paint, tea, and for tougher enforcement. So once again, the colonists rallied against the new taxes. So if they wanted to import any of those things, tea in particular, we removed the Boston Tea Party, but paint, glass paint, these are things, British manufactured goods, the people at the ports would actually just take a fraction, skim a fraction off to get it in. Massachusetts put a petition to the king and not parliament to remove the excess taxes. It says every merchants in every colony except New Hampshire joined the new non-importation agreement. So what happened is that they decided we're just not going to import any of these things. I'll just have to read. I think this is down to the Boston Tea Party coming along. No. There's something called a circular letter. Oh, this is a letter. It's not a circular letter, but it's a letter that's actually sent from place to place. This is a circular letter for the assemblies. Also sent a message called a circular letter to the other colonial assemblies. It suggested the colonies met again. So all the colonies agreed, and it was an effective anti-British economic measure. You can mention the first measure of they stopped buying British goods, and that caused pain to Parliament. So you can see it worked the second time. Now you've got to remember that. The charters were revoked, and they put in governors similar to what we have in Australia. We've got a governor general, but he dissolved the assembly because it wouldn't cancel the circular letter. So this is the Boston one. This began to work, and so he dropped everything except for the duty on tea. This way it was keeping the sort of backing down a second time, and keeping one on tea was a face saving message. Oh yes, so this goes in that the British began to send more soldiers. They jeered the soldiers, and a soldier accidentally fired his gun, and the other soldiers opened fire. Within minutes, three colonists were dead. So it's just one of these powder keg stories going across. Then what happened is that Britain, which had the East India Company, had too much tea. The company was failing, so they went to thought, "Oh, we can organise that. We'll send our tea to Boston." And the Bostons organised a people dressed as North American Indians. I remember actually going to Boston and having that discussion. So they disguised North American Indians. Now, for some reason, I knew that as a kid, as a 12-year-old kid, I knew that's what happened, but I couldn't quite work out why. The Boston Tea Party upset people, so this is where they just chucked out stuff. So you can imagine it's more economic sabotage against the British companies. British, so they're overextended. They're in India at the moment. One observer reported, determination to enforce obedience of the colonies to the laws of revenue by the most powerful means seems as firm as possible, and the government appears stronger than I have ever known. So the after the Boston Tea Party, they had four new laws. So this Parliament, who's now given its right to make laws for the colonies. The Coercive Act, so there's the four laws, aimed to force colonists to obey the law. One closed the Boston Harbour to all trade. Another revoked the Charter of Massachusetts, take away the colony's form of self-government. The third prevented colonial courts from bringing royal officials to trial, while the fourth required colonists to allow British soldiers to stay in their homes. Now that would be, that's sort of like, you can imagine just really, really rough, you know, rough justice. So you imagine all that. And at the end of it, you can imagine you're at home. Who's in the back bedroom? Oh, it's just a soldier. The British also replaced the governor of Massachusetts with General Thomas Gage, the commander of all British forces in the colonies. In May, he landed in Boston with four regiments of soldiers. So they just got pretty upset by the Boston Tea Party. That really pissed them off. And you can see the mounting British power. I wonder how they actually organised it. So the British got upset and got rid of... They said, well, the self-government's over. I'm just trying to think. So their governor was the American general, the sort of MacArthur or something like that. The Quebec Act. The Quebec Act is that, so they had, Britain had gained all of French America and French, you know, the French areas. Yes, so the Quebec Act allowed, now you've got to remember that they had banned Catholics. Catholics were being treated really badly, and you've got to understand that in areas the Protestants were taken badly and all the Catholics were treated badly. It just so happened that the English were treating the Catholics badly, and so it went from Catholic to Protestant, sort of the pendulum landed on the Protestants. And to this day, you're very hard to get anywhere in Britain if you're Catholic still. And the Quebec Act said that you could have, Catholics could hold offices, create a legislature of appointed, not elected members. The colonists, however, viewed with alarm, mostly Protestants, had no sympathy for Catholics. So, the laws extended to Illinois, where some French settlers lived. This made Catholicism acceptable in the land of American colonists was there. Colonists lumped the Quebec Act together with the Coercive Acts. They called these intolerable acts. So one was the Coercive Act of just letting British soldiers to suddenly sit in your home. Who's that? Who's that in the pantry? Oh, it's a British soldier. Who's that in front of the telly? Oh, it's one of the British soldiers. Oh, my God. And then if you really hated Catholics and French, as you did, go there. So this is really interesting, these little French enclaves in there. So Congress assembled in 1774, that's 2 years before the war, and it's in Philadelphia. It'd be interesting to know, I'm quite confused the difference between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh myself in my head. 56 delegates from every colony except Georgia attended, and they endorsed something called the Suffolk Resolves, which had been passed by a Boston Town Meeting, so that little resolves, I don't know how they go, and it urged the colonists to train militia units. So this is really interesting, this idea of having meetings and passing them, you know, to get something with a bit of authority, you know. Delegates approved a statement to be sent to Britain spelling out their against coercive acts of the Quebec Act, British troops in colonial towns. It's declared what they were for, the right of assembly rather than parliament to impose taxes on the colonies. Finally, the delegates agreed to meet again in the spring. The situation, the ball was in Britain's court.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.